Welcome to another broadcast of Philosophic Perspectives on the Artist First Radio Network. All past shows are archived, and you can pick them up at artistfirst.com. And now here's your host, Arthur D. Schwartz.
Well, hello again. Welcome to another edition of Philosophic Perspectives. This is going to be a really different show tonight because this actually has been pre-recorded. We're sitting in a restaurant in Watertown, Massachusetts, and the Social Philosophizers Club has a periodically recurring event called the Impromptu Philosophizer. And so the Impromptu Philosophizer, as it suggests, is impromptu. It's spontaneous. It's very much like improv. It's about calling an event and just having people contribute and what's on their mind, what they're interested in. It talks about personal things, political things, philosophical things, all kinds of things with a philosophical slash intellectual bent, and it's meant to be fun as well as edifying. And so here we are, and this is truly an improvisational impromptu tonight. My guests tonight are... may I use your first names? Yas. Larry. I can say Larry Spencer. He's been a guest on the show before. Barry.
And Josh.
And Josh. Josh is the first time to the impromptu, so it's, I think, interesting that this is your first exposure to our club, and I hope you enjoy it. Now, the notion of impromptu is, in my mind, itself extremely philosophical, because philosophy is a very fertile thing. You get into a subject, and anything can prick and start off a lengthy conversation. Philosophy, one might say, is the art of making big things out of what might appear to be little things, because I believe the expression of the little things are the big things. And that's not, I think that's really true. Little things, little lies, little behaviors can turn out to be big things, maybe not for the situation at hand, but in terms of, let's say, the greater society, the rudeness, let's say, the petty thefts, let's say, the arrogance, let's say, all kinds of things, when we multiply them over and over again, maybe become big things. Of course, I remember taking my car to a mechanic, and I forget what it was, but he just told me, don't sweat the little things. But in philosophy, I think sometimes the little things are the big things. So as we begin tonight, I would like you to begin this conversation to spin off in this kind of spirit that I'm suggesting here, the spirit of improvisational philosophy. We were talking, and we don't have to continue this, Mr. Spencer, but we did talk about, you know, the very unusual political year we're having, and the philosophical ramifications of what this means for American politics, what it says about American politics, what it says about America, what it says about the two-party system, what it says about Donald Trump, what it says about Hillary Clinton, two very controversial figures and very, very different. So I can keep on talking, but rather than doing that, I'm going to look around this little tight table in the coffee shop that we're sitting in Watertown, Massachusetts, and see, before I go any further, if someone here has something they want to say, either as a spinoff of my little impromptu about impromptu, or about something else. Any hands going up before I continue to talk? There's a ticker. Okay, Larry.
Yeah, just chipping in about philosophy and politics, I will opine that Barack Obama is an exceptionally philosophical president, and I think that either of the two people that is slated to succeed him, Clinton or Trump, is much less so. Anyone care to comment about that?
He's a philosophical president.
Barry?
When you say philosophical president, I take it that you say that in a good way, in a good thing.
Yes, I do take that as a good thing. And what I mean by it is I think Barack Obama is exceptionally careful and deliberative. I don't think he just acts by reflex. I think he thinks things through. You may agree or disagree with him, but I think he's a careful thinker. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't need to say that Trump is not a careful thinker. Hillary Clinton has a reputation, that's somewhat well-deserved, I think, as being more of a triangulator than a thinker. But I think Barack Obama takes a philosophical approach, which I'm going to miss.
My personal feeling, so there's no way nobody could have done better. Nobody could have done anything. And I think he said things which made me feel like in ways had been disillusioned. When he was running for president the second time, somebody said, well, we'd be really upset if you don't win. And he said, no, I'll be relieved in the sense that it won't be so exhausting. And he said something, who would want this job? So, you know, it made me realize that he had been disillusioned.
It seems like he's hit his stride, though, more than most outgoing presidents do, to a fault, according to some people. Would you agree that he's getting a lot more done now than one might expect?
I'm not sure. It's hard to say. I mean, you know, I think that there are good things that, but he's, you know, I think he's too much into trying to find, you know, consensus or trying to be fair to the other person's point of view, in the sense that if the other person's point of view is we're going to just oppose you no matter what you do, then it's hard to be fair to that, you know, that point of view. It's so nihilistic. And my feeling is that, I'm really curious to see how history ranks him as a president, because I think he had good intentions, you know, but I don't think he achieved much. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, if I may add to that, it prompts a question to me. Like, if you look at society today, I think the problems that we're facing are extremely complex and require a lot of thought, and it often takes a considerable amount of time before any measures that we take actually we see the results of that. So you want maybe philosophical, or at least like a rational and thinking president, but at the same time you see that forces in society are very impatient, right? And and people want to see change yesterday, or if not yesterday, then at least tomorrow. And I wonder if that sort of dichotomy between the complexity of the problems, on the other hand, and the immediate need for change, how that will influence the political landscape that we're seeing.
Well, let me just say this. I actually had a mischievous thought, it lasted with me for several days. I said, maybe the idea is to vote for the Republicans, because I want them to fall flat in their face when they see how difficult it is to be president. Then they'll really get the...
Josh, do you have anything yet?
Yeah. I think this conversation is really kind of crystallized in thinking about Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton. Because I think Sanders has very idealistic philosophy, and I'm not sure that Clinton, philosophy-wise, is very different, but she's, I think, more practical. So I think that's I think people might agree with both of their ideas, but it's a question of what's realistic and what's going to get stuff done.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of this reminds me of style and, style and action. Style and concrete action, because part of things, both in Sanders and Trump, but certainly with Trump, some people just like the fact that he's bombastic and he says outrageous things. And you know, sometimes he might say something that I might personally tend to agree with. However, I'm not sure. I think a president or a leader could benefit by some ability to shake the apple cart, to be unconventional. I think we need that. At the same time, I think a leader needs to be stable, and a leader needs to be believable. Now, that actually is really one of the – that's, I think, the crux of the crisis that a lot of people feel, because whether – because the two presumptive nominees, Trump and Clinton, both have huge trust problems, according to the polls, believability. And it, without believability, the electorate is put in crisis. Now, that goes back to, I mean, the thing about Trump is, you know what? I mean, honestly, I say this not as conviction, as just simply observation. I've said this before. The man's a liar. I mean, he just says things, and he's constantly contradicting himself. He says things one day, and, you know, the example I gave, he said, well, when he was asked about retracting or rejecting the endorsement by David Duke, the former Ku Klux Klan leader. And he said, I don't even know who this guy is. I don't know this David Duke, blah, blah, blah. And then it came out a couple days later that he was actually interviewed on the Today Show by Matt Lauer, I believe it was Matt Lauer. And Matt Lauer, you know, and they were talking, and Trump was saying at that time, in the 90s, how bad a person this David Duke was. So then a couple days later, I heard Trump say, of course I don't accept David Duke's support. So the thing is, he is just saying whatever comes out of his mouth, and that doesn't lead to trustability or confidence that the leader is going to do what he says he's going to do.
Yes?
Yeah, but so another question is, like, why? Like, why do we let him get away with it? Why do we apply different standards to Donald Trump as compared to other politicians that we deal with? So apparently, like in the if you look at other politicians, like the most minute inconsistencies in their stories are often pointed out and made turn into very big stories. People that have said something years ago, and nowadays with the internet, it's very easy to find like the complete record of something that someone has said. And politicians, we typically don't let them get away with it, even to the point, I would say, that. If they legitimately changed their mind because new facts came to light or new insights evolved, we find it very bad if people then change their mind. Why do we let Donald Trump get away with it? Like, why a different standard for him? And what does that say about the politics of this day and age?
Well, in my opinion... I would say that the... one of the reasons is because he attracted a whole new voter. I mean, he keeps bragging. These voters never voted before. Many of them do not have a high educational level. And so the fact that he's going around using the F word is, I guess, thought about as somebody who they can relate to. I mean, that sounds to be rather crass, but I mean, I think it's partially correct. And the other thing about it is the idea that... some people just want to see a rabble rouser. Someone want to see, you know, the wall go up. They just want to see, Trump endorsed, breaking international law by encouraging torture. And so they want the outrages because they're fed up. And I'm not exactly, I think we have a perfect storm that's happened because, let's face it, history is changing. The communications we have today is nothing like what ever has been in the past. And so you have a guy like Donald Trump, and he can captivate the media and suddenly get all this free advertising, ironically, for the one guy who doesn't need free advertising. He's the one who's getting it. And it's everything has become, reality television, which he, of course, starred in. Somehow, what's the expression of, truth of stranger, fiction imitates, what's it? Truth of stranger in fiction or imitation or fiction imitates reality, I think. And I think that actually is the case. The thing is about Trump, too. I mean, there's a lot of things that people are, some people claim he's an authoritarian. I don't know if that's really the case. I do see certain things that he's done that do give me that impression. I know in one case it was in reference to the Speaker of the House. The other reference, unfortunately, it might have been McCain. I'm not sure who he was referring to, but he said the same thing. I remember very well. You're free to look it up on Google. I'm sure it will come up. Where he said in respect to the House Speaker Ryan and to somebody else, he said the same thing. He said he better watch himself. He better watch it. So, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, what does that mean? To me, it sounds an awful lot like a threat. And so, he knows what he's saying. And you know, it strikes me as amazing that he was never really called on it. He does get away with things, and I think it's because he has tapped into an element that if I'm, I will say this, because I do have more faith in this country than maybe sometimes it seems to seems warranted. I don't think Donald Trump will be elected because of the amount of antipathy he has created. The only chance he has is because Hillary has a lot of negatives too, but does not nearly as much as Trump's. I mean, he's alienated about 70% of the women voters. He's alienated about 100% of the Hispanic voters. He's alienated Muslim voters because he doesn't want them to come in. So I guess they can't vote. Period. I mean, he's basically alienated almost everybody, pretty much. I don't think that's a winning prescription, so I do not think he will win. However, it's more disturbing to me because I don't think he'll actually get elected once those commercials start running, that over and over and over again see the idiocy that he actually put on the stage, a presidential debate, looking at these candidates acting like spoiled school children. I mean, that's a disgrace, but you know what? It's serious because these things have an effect. The young people watching this is they're going to be their idea of politics, and so I think what he has done is a disgrace. But I do give the country more credit than that. The bigger problem is, what is the impact? What's the next election cycle 4 years from now going to be? Will there be a return to civility? Or will Trump now be sort of viewed as the new way of politics? That you can be a bombast, that you can be a liar, that you can be a swearer, you know, that you can say, you don't have to even check your facts. I mean, the facts are just completely irrelevant. Just says what he wants to say. And so that to me is the bigger question. But for now, I'm pretty confident he will not get elected. You heard it here, folks. Barry.
Okay. Yeah, I think I agree with everything you're saying, Arthur, but I think it's even worse than that. I think it's even more dangerous than that. I mean, you know, when have we had campaign presentations or campaign events where, you know, there's actually been violence before, where there are protesters, there's been violence? And I think that the reason that's so is because Trump, as somebody said, caters to the worst in people. And that's scary because, you know, he, number one, has got convictions that are so dogmatic. I'm right, everybody else is wrong. That right there scares me. Number two, he's actually contemptuous. He's contemptuous of people. I mean, the way he talks about people insulting them is contemptuous. And it's like, I have a friend who I really am very close to, and she really likes Trump a lot. And so I said, okay, I'll look at his policies. She says, don't look at his personality, look at his policies. But the thing is, it's hard to know what his policies are because they keep on changing all the time. So I get the feeling either this is a joke for him, like, you know, he got into it, like, you know, that's, you know, almost like a reality show in itself, you know, as a joke, that he just did this as a joke and didn't realize what would happen. Or he really doesn't realize the seriousness of what he's doing. Because it's pretty serious, you know. And is he going to change his spots, you know, all of a sudden? And yeah.
What you were just referring to there, Barry, is it goes back to what I said when I opened the show. The little things are the big things. I really do feel that in addition to the big things, clearly big things, big issues that he's back and forth about, yes, the behavior, what some people would say, well, so what? Doesn't matter. Those little things are very big things. You know, there is a book written by a French philosopher. I'm forgetting the name of the gentleman, but it's I have it on my bookshelf. It's a book of virtues. But what I really like in the book is the first virtue he used, opening up the book, is he goes from the least important to the most important. And the most trivial of virtues, he says, was politeness. Because politeness is so easily faked. You can be really a monster of a person, but be very, very polite. And I agree with that. However, let me just say this. While politeness is, I would probably agree, the most unimportant of the virtues because it's so easily faked and so easily done, a virtue is a virtue because it's difficult, you know, to be virtuous sometimes. Politeness is still important. It really is. I mean, even though it's the least important of the virtues, it's still important because it creates a civility. The United States of America, one of the standout qualities of us as a country historically is that despite the Civil War and things like that, which is obviously a horrendous period of history for those 4 years, and of course the years of Jim Crow in the South and all that, still, generally speaking, our politics has been much more civil than in other parts of the world. I mean, we have a kind of civility, and we you know, just much more so. And even though I'm opposed to the two-party system has something to do with that. I don't think we need a two-party system to have civility. So the big things are the little things, but the big things are the big things too. And so that's what's troubling about the acceptability of what is not. It goes beyond, you know, new ideas. I'm all for new ideas. I'm all for thinking outside the box. I'm all for breaking convention. But I think simple, ordinary decency matters a lot, maybe more than any of these other issues in the long run. Thank you, Barry. Okay, you couldn't hear him from, but he was agreeing with me. Thank you, Barry. Okay, anyone else want to chime in? Well, you know what? It might be a good time. That's a perfect break because we're right at the halfway point. So we're going to take a little break now, and we'll be back shortly.
Enjoys intellectual social interaction and finds digging deeper into the nature of things, from big issues to everyday life, an important part of the pleasure of life. Social Philosophizers is a Boston-area social club for those who desire intellectual socializing. It's a club for both singles and non-singles, and for anyone who finds intellectually mingling to be the best form of social mingling. The club offers a variety of interesting venues, such as philosophical get-togethers in private venues, book discussions concerning literature and philosophy, topical discussions over brunch or dinner, guest speakers, theater, after-work mixers, even long philosophical ruminations along nature trails or city streets and more. If you live in the greater Boston area or occasionally spend time in the area, you can choose a cost-effective membership level that's right for you. Basic membership is free. Find the link on Arthur's Philosophical Perspectives show page at artistverse.com or just search socialphilosophizers.com. We hope you'll join Social Philosophizers today. That's socialphilosophizers.com. In Ethical Empowerment, Virtue Beyond the Paradigms, Arthur D. Schwartz presents an ethical theory that is a framework for evaluating moral conundrums that go beyond legalistic rulemaking, dogmatism, and preconditioned thinking. The book is as much an ethical framework for unconventional ideas as it is for staying with convention. Ethical Empowerment is a manifesto of non-doctrinaire perspective. Ultimately, the hypnotic thinking of ideology and dogmatism can only be overcome by returning to the true source and essence of morality, which is nothing less than universal love. Discover how the philosophically liberating approach of the ethical empowerment can be applied to the range of ethical, social, and political controversy. Read about a plan to eliminate all political parties. Entertain the possibility of an overhaul of the patent system and its replacement with a system that rewards inventors while eliminating monopolistic control of patents and technological suppression. Many other transformative ideas are discussed in the book, including issues related to the monetary system, real estate, scientific paradigms, and a rational approach to conspiracy theory. While ethical empowerment will challenge your mind to consider new perspectives, the ethical challenge is always to keep the diversity, depth, and breadth of perspective within the boundaries of love. Ethical Empowerment is available at Amazon.com and most online booksellers in both print and ebook editions.
Okay, so we are back. So I had this idea, and I discussed with the group a little bit, that we're going to transition a little bit here. We talked about, I started off talking about impromptu improvisational acting, you know, that kind of thing about politics has a sort of a spontaneity to it. Then we moved into talking about, you know, the favorite subject right now, the political system season, which is the most unusual season I can remember in my relatively long lifetime. And I'll give you a hint. The first campaign election I voted for was McGovern. Yeah, it was. That was the first presidential election. That was my first election, and so now the thing that we're talking about now is this election is so strange, and then the question becomes: well, does it really matter? Is anything going to change? And is it because of the economy, the powers that be? Is it because of the big corporations are running everything? Is it because of other institutional interests or special interest groups? Or is it the government inside the government? Is it that sort of shadow government that conspiracy theorists like to think about? I like to think about these things as well. I'm kind of an all of the above guy. I think they all play a role. To a certain degree, I think a case can be made it doesn't make a difference. So, as a follow-up to our discussion of Trumpism and Hillary Clintonism to a lesser degree, we should have a show with more about Hillary next time. I would like to get people's take upon the level of, does it really matter? Larry.
All right, I think that for those of us seated around this table in the relatively prosperous state of Massachusetts with a great business economy, we'll all get by. I think neither candidate nor Sanders, if he becomes the candidate, is going to be able to run the entire economy into the ground, so we'll be fine. But I can think of two groups of people to whom it will matter a great deal. One is the people that are more on the margins of society than we are. I'm thinking, for example, of President Obama's recent actions on behalf of LGBT people. If, let's say, Ted Cruz were in the White House instead of Barack Obama, there's a whole group of people that would be enjoying a lot less respect and public support. Another group that's easily marginalized are racial minorities, and there's lots of action that the federal government can take to prohibit discrimination and so on. But then a larger group of people that this election could matter a great deal for is people who are in countries that are going to get submerged in 50 years as sea levels rise. And we are really at our last crossroads, our last chance to arrest global warming. And if we don't do something, it's going to be irreversible. Maybe it already is. President Obama has taken some actions, probably too little, too late, or at least too late. I guess it remains to be seen if it's too little. But you know that if a climate change denier gets in the White House for another 4 or 8 years, it really is going to be too late, and that will matter a great deal.
Yeah, I would like to add that I think that the philosophical underpinnings of our entire system of democracy is to prevent any single person from having an outrageous contribution.
Have an outrageous contribution?
Yeah. But the fact is that sometimes one person can provide the leadership, everyone else falls behind, or falls in line, but without that leader, you don't get started.
Josh?
What was I going to say? Now I've lost my train of thought. You don't have to go to someone else while I regain my train of thought.
It'll come back. Yoss, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a trend in society. And I think no leader or no elected official will buck that trend. There's obviously some variation that they can impose on that trend. And if you're one of the people that is just, there'll definitely be people impacted by whoever gets into the White House. But I think the general trend in society for LGBT people, even if Ted Cruz would be in the White House, which I personally would think would be a terrible idea, definitely some people will have negative consequences from that. But the general trend towards broader acceptance of people of all stripes and colors and creeds will continue, even though conservative forces might sort of conspire, in my sense, it's a rearguard action in many aspects. But I would like to say that, yeah, I think it doesn't matter that much.
Barry?
Yeah, I think that there's two factors here. There's two ways of looking at this, both really important. One is I think that we really are in a situation of voting for the least of two evils. It's that serious, I think. Because if we focus on the money being spent in Obamacare, that's missing the whole point, which is prevention.
Well, that sounds kind of really idealistic to me, and
like to quote Mr. Fuller. Quoting about Mr. Fuller, anybody who sees today's situation to be an idealist is to be a realist.
I think ideals take a long time to take root in large societies. When they're divided opinion, so which we are in this country is very, very divided. So yeah, I can pass it on to someone else.
I think with some of the topics we're talking about, we have had a long time for ideals to take root. Talk about ecology, that's been really, I guess it started with the book Silent Spring. What was that? Written in the 1950s or something? Yeah. And that ecological movement has slowly been building, as we've slowly been doing very little, to the point where now the planet is in danger. Well, it's not in danger at this minute, but it's in danger of irreparably being in danger. Or some of the civil rights issues we've been talking about, those have been really on people's minds since the Civil War in one way or another. So I think we've had a lot of time to build consensus.
No, but I would say like the concept of ideals, sort of, if you have an ideal, you also claim to know the truth and to know that that is the thing worth striving for, that that is the correct thing, the right thing to do, the thing worth striving for. And over time, I think we found that none of these ideas of absolute truth really led to a working situation. And what I love about our democratic system is the concept of shared truth, where it's not my ideals or his ideals or her ideals or anyone's ideals, but it's in the battlefield of these ideals and compromise and discussion that we get to some sort of shared understanding of what we want to strive for. I think the current ideas about equality of genders and LGBT, it took like thousands and sometimes longer, like thousands of years to get to the current level of understanding. And modern ideals like, should everyone have healthcare for free? Should we have a basic income? Should there be protection of people because of like who they are, where they're from, or how smart they are, or like whatever? These are the current battlefields. Like so, and I love the idea that we need to compromise and fight and figure out where the shared middle ground is.
That's what you said is so important. You know what you said about the dangers of having such strong convictions or thinking you have the only truth, the objective truth. Well, I want to say something that I think is really the most encouraging thing that's happening right now. Is I don't think that the next paradigm is going to be an ideology. See, in the past it's been, we have objective truth, we have the right ideology. I think we see now the dangers of ideology, we see now the dangers of our mind and not being responsible for what we're creating. And I think that the next paradigm is going to be humility. I mean, there's a book by a lady that made A Course in Miracles popular, Marianne Williamson, and she wrote a book called The New America. And then she said, the only thing that's going to work, wouldn't it be wonderful if we realized that we had to laugh at our idea of having objective truth? And the new paradigm is one that laughs at the idea of having objective truth, and therefore literally is not so attached to my way is the only way. And she said that in the future, wouldn't it be great, and isn't it possibly evolving to this, where Congress will start by saying, well, we are Democrats, and we recognize we don't have the whole truth. We recognize you as Republicans also have a valid point of view, and we're really going to be open to listen to what you have to say, and please be open to what we have to say. And it'll be a totally different kind of politics. Anything short of that, I think, is not seeing how serious it is.
Barry, how would that concept of humility and not claiming an objective truth work in an area that's really a scientific question, where presumably there is an objective truth, even though we might not know what it is, but there is one, and I'm thinking of global warming. How would you make progress on that if neither side is allowed to say we really know what's going on?
Well, I wish you gave me a little more time to think about the answer.
I think even in an area like this, my quibble about global warming has always been, like, I mean, either it's happening and then we're not going to stop it, or it's not happening and then we don't have to worry about it. Like, so even if you accept and you know that there's a scientific truth that the Earth is warming up, then the second question is, does that matter? And at the end,
you don't think we can stop it?
At the end of the day, if you say, like, well, it matters, then you say I place a value on the survival of the human race. And I think, like, you know, The sun is going to expand, it's going to gobble up the Earth in a couple of billion years. So the only question is, how big will the party be until we get there? So even acceptance of a fact doesn't say anything about the worthfulness of the goal that you're then trying to achieve. Like, to prevent it, stop it, control it, further it. There's people that I don't personally agree with who think that global warming is great because it will hasten the second coming of Jesus Christ, and they think that that's a worthwhile goal. I think they're wrong, but I'll happily chat to them about that.
So you said you think you're wrong, so you'll have a chat with them about it, or
I think they are wrong.
Yeah.
I think they are wrong.
That's what I meant to say. Yeah, so this is what I was talking about before, that unless we can at least agree that there's such a thing as objective truth in these areas, then we might as well all become nihilists and say the sun's going to gobble us up in 5 billion years anyway, and let's just go out in an early blaze of glory rather than a later one.
No, that
doesn't seem ethical to me.
Well, I want to just interject a little bit of what Barry said, because, I mean, I agree with Barry very much about, you know, the next ideology is going to be the non-ideology. And I certainly, for those of you who know my thing, I mean, I agree with that wholeheartedly. But I do think, too, in the global warming thing, it is very interesting to see where the party line is really surfacing in this argument, and I think even among scientists, about, you know, if you're, I think some Republican scientists might say, well, you know, it's actually no global warming. We're just going through, a trend that, you know, and there are, you know, atmospheric trends. But that's the minority. But the thing is that scientists, too, are just like everybody else, and they have their opinions, and the opinions are very important. They build their career on opinions. And the point I want to make here is the infrastructure, let's say, of science, or the infrastructure of academia, because I think we need to clear away the motivation, bad motivations that we really, in the universities, we want to see the only motivation should be knowledge, should be learning. It should not be saving your tenureship or not getting fired because you're bucking the tide, because you're breaking the accepted paradigm. Unfortunately, a lot of that does go on. I definitely believe in global warming myself personally. I mean, I'm not actually qualified to say, but I believe that there's really global warming going on. It seems that way to me. However, it's also true that there's a lot of political interests that are trying to enforce it. What didn't it come out recently about they were playing around with the statistics? That came out a couple of years ago. Someone was monkeying around with the. Do you know what I'm referring to?
There's been a lot of playing around.
But playing around. So I mean, so all I'm saying is, I think on a more fundamental level, I think science and everybody else needs to check their biases, to be as objective as possible, and that means many times looking at where the money comes from.
And if I were a scientist who wanted to make a lot of money, I would perceive immediately that there is an enormous market niche that would pay me very well to say the right things on behalf of oil companies.
So in that case, I can recommend the book Merchants of Doubt. That is about a bunch of guys that have actually figured that out.
I think that, you know, what is coming and what's very clear is I don't say that it's going to be the next coming of Christ or anything, but I think that we're reaching a place where we're really, the opportunity or the possibility or, you know, the possibility and the opportunity is that we really can get a society that is exactly what Arthur's saying, that is much more ethical, that is much more based on humility, because I think that things have gotten so ridiculous, you know, that people are seeing, and that there's a alternative that's coming through the grassroots, an alternative that isn't people yelling at each other, isn't people, you know, that may sound idealistic, but I agree with Buckminster Fuller, to be an idealist at this time is the only way to be a realist. And, you know, the thing is, it gets to me to be a spiritual problem. What I mean by a spiritual problem is we have to look at things like the ego. So, see, what has been our paradigm for truth has been science. And science is really valuable, but I see it as a secondary truth. The most important truth is that we see, you know, as human beings, that we all have this ego, that we literally are, you know, constantly, since we live moment to moment to moment, many moments we really are judgmental, many moments we're really numb, we're not in touch with our true emotions often. You know, I mean, this is basic psychotherapy. You know, the ego defenses. And if we see all these ways in which we really are not, that we really are misguided if we trust our mind so much, you know, and we reach a state of humility, I think everything else will follow, including science that is ethical, science that is, but right now science is the paradigm of truth, not spiritual values. I'm not talking about religion. Not talking
about religion. Does anyone want to have a last comment?
Okay, so we're going to just begin to wrap this up here. This has been an experiment. I think not so much the conversation, but the technology that we have here might have to be improved. So we'll see how this goes. But I think it's really a fun time. I think it does have a lot of possibility once we perfect it. And so we'll have to see. But I think we can do this again. I want to thank Yas, Larry, Barry, and Josh for participating today on tonight's program. I'm really happy you did it. I hope you enjoyed it, and I think we can do it again. What do you think?
Sure.
It will be improved. Our technology will improve. So we're going to wrap this up right now, and this is just another episode of or installment of Philosophic Perspectives. And so I want to thank my guests. And so for links to my book, Ethical Empowerment, my philosophical counseling and hypnotherapy practice, and the Social Philosophizers Club, please visit arthurdschwartz.com. And this is Arthur D. Schwartz reminding you to live well and think deeply. So until next time, good night, everybody. This is Arthur D. Schwartz. You know, beliefs and disbeliefs can be very powerful. Much like philosophy, hypnotism is concerned with belief. Hypnotherapy, a practical application of hypnotism, may largely be described as the practice of removing false beliefs that form mental blocks to success, to happiness, and to well-being. In my hypnotherapy and philosophical counseling practice, I combine my work in philosophy with hypnotism in order to clear mental blockages that can occur on both conscious and subconscious levels. A mental block may be conscious or subconscious and can be expressed, for example, in the form of anxiety, low self-esteem or low motivation, bad habits, tobacco habits, weight gain, low performance, and much more. If you are interested in using hypnosis and the power of the mind to overcome mental blocks and barriers that have emerged in your life, please feel free to give me a call at 617-964-4800 or visit www.integralhypnosis.com. That's integral hypnosis.com.